Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. Now, usually on Sunday nights, we have Tanya Talks, which is a very, very popular show, but she has agreed to switch with us so we could get these people on this evening when they were available. So Tanya will be back on Tuesday night. And so for those of you listening that are worried about that, she will be there. Tonight, we're going to be covering more on what's going on in California in the ongoing assault on seniors and the disabled and so on. And before we get to that, I want to remind everyone that these shows are brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit taking place in Washington, D.C. this July from the 28th through the 31st. The summit is open to the public, and barring them putting us under medical martial law over this faked up virus crap, we'll all be there. I am anticipating. They've got everything set up and ready to go, and I have my own thoughts about all that, but we'll have that conversation another day. But anyway, please, if you can make it out there and we're able to travel at that time, we'd love to see you there. Last year, our panel out there accounted for a 200% increase in attendance to the summit, and I think that's quite a feather for all of us in our caps, that as word is spreading and people are becoming informed about what is happening to the elderly in this country, the theft of estates, the abuse, the loss of rights, the neglect, then the predation that is going on by these professional predators called guardians in conjunction with a probate hearing examiner who facilitates the whole racket, we are all in dire need of being rescued. We need help. For those of you who haven't gotten involved yet, there are many, many good groups out there. Some, of course, you should avoid. There's always those in every issue. You'll learn quickly. You'll learn on your own. But just get involved. Get involved. We need all the voices we can get. We need all the support we can get. And for God's sake, when somebody's having a meeting or a rally or a protest, get up and present yourself. I don't know what it's going to take to get people on their feet. I really don't. But we need your physical presence. We need you to be there. We need you to speak out. We need you to support what everybody is trying to do to get this system stopped. They are wiping out a huge number of us. Hospice, as many of you know, has become the Grim Reaper. We have, over the last 6 months, rescued 4 people from hospice that were said to have a terminal illness that never did and are quite alive and well today. If you listen to our shows on hospice with Marcia Joyner, the stories coming out of their families watching their loved one be murdered right in front of their eyes, and many of them in tears afterwards and suffering the psychological effects of realizing that they were being murdered right in front of them, but they didn't know what till it was too late. And so avoid hospice. You have the right to revoke hospice at any time, unless you're under a guardianship or conservatorship, and then they can put you in and take you out all at the same time. You see how that works? Anyway, and also joining us tonight is Stephen Burke with KLRB Radio out of Stuart, Oklahoma, Christian Lighthouse Radio. They're streaming the show live there in Oklahoma. Thank you, Stephen. Things are booming. We have several other stations that have picked us up, and I'll be producing a list of those here in the next week or so. We're being picked up in many, many places. So with that said, our guest tonight, our main guest, is Linda Kincaid, and many of you already know Linda. She used to co-host these shows for a while, but is so involved with her organization and the work that she does trying to rectify the wrongdoing in California. Linda became involved when her own mother was subjected to this system, and they poked the wrong dog with the stick there. Linda, welcome to the show, and it's nice to have you back on again. She's not talking. Linda?
Oh, now you've unmuted me. Thank you, Marty. So many people are trying to shut me up, and now Marty Oakley is too.
No, no way, girlfriend. No way.
I couldn't let that go. Marty, thank you so much for having us on. Thanks for making time for us tonight. We've got two stories that I think are really going to rattle people, because we mostly hear about guardianship, conservatorship as an issue affecting the elderly, but these two stories tonight are about younger persons who have disabilities. And guess what? There's federal money.
Go ahead.
Marty, are you playing with the mute button?
No, somebody is playing with us, but go ahead, Linda.
Okay, I'll just keep on yammering until somebody mutes me. Well,
there you go.
the three of us, myself and your other two guests tonight, were at a conference in Sacramento over the weekend. And if I may, I'd like to go through my slides really quickly, and then I'll get out of the way and let them tell their own family stories. So shall
sure.
I just go right into my slides?
Yes.
Well, my title
yes.
slide was California Conservatorship Driven by Dollars. And you were just saying, like, you know, what's causing this? What's behind it all? Well, money, of course. Money's behind almost everything that happens that goes wrong. On my slide number three, I referenced an article that came out just last week. Federal court equates guardianship to racketeering. And if anybody
yes.
wants the link to that, I'm sure Marty has it or I can provide it. I look mostly in California. And in California, we call it conservatorship. Because we're Californian, we have to be different. But when I say conservatorship, I'm talking about the same thing that nearly everyone else is going to call guardianship.
Yes.
But my slide number four talks about conservators, bill by the hour. Conservators' attorneys, bill by the hour. Court-appointed attorneys, bill by the hour. Guardians ad litem, bill by the hour. Experts, bill by the hour. Family's attorneys, bill by the hour. Have you picked up a pattern here?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So it's in the interest of all of these people who are billing by the hour to keep the conflict going, keep the dispute going. If you want your family member to stay at home, they'll try to put them in a facility. If you want them to go into a facility, they'll try to put them at home. If you want them to have a certain doctor, they'll try to get somebody else or maybe no doctor at all. But the bottom line is whatever the family wants, the people on the other side will oppose it, because every time you go to court, it's $10,000, $15,000 in all of their pockets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, yeah, we first encountered that in my mom's case, where we were hearing after hearing after hearing after hearing after hearing, and nothing ever got done. We were bringing in all this evidence, all these issues, and the judge would just say, oh, well, now you all go see if you can work something out and then come back next month and let me know. And we went through this over and over and over and over, and I finally figured out, oh, they're all getting paid every time we come to court. These guys in suits are lined up in front of the table, and each one of them is pocketing $10,000 every time we come to court. So
yep.
that really is the motivation behind it, as far as I've been able to see.
Yes.
And so that's the gospel according to Linda Kincaid. And now I will get out of the way and let you talk to Sally and Monica.
Well, Linda, you know, in respect to your case, the one thing I remember about it at the time was you finding your mother in one of these facilities sleeping on a mattress on the floor. And supposedly this was a better situation for her than to be cared for at home. I can't imagine what my reaction would have been to that. I'd have probably ended up in jail. What happens to our elderly people in these warehouses they call nursing homes? And we've got a president who now wants to ease the requirements for nursing homes, the standard they have to abide by, because apparently it's just too difficult for them to do all the things they said they could do that they're charging you all this money for. And so I don't know how that's going to come out. Linda, before we get to our guests, here in Minnesota, you may remember last year, early in the year, our Health and Human Services Director was allowed to resign to keep all of his benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of being fired, because there were 26,000 uninvestigated nursing home complaints. As if that wasn't bad enough, we get a new director, and within 6 months, they claim they have solved and taken care of 17,000 of those. And somebody said, how could they possibly do this? The manpower would be just, I said, it was very simple. We have an abatement clause in the statutes, which says that if you have one of these suits in progress for abuse and neglect in these nursing homes, and the person on whose behalf you have done this died, the case ends. No case. No problem, no crime. That's how they got 17. That's the number of people who died in these conditions
of
neglect.
They
just closed the case. And everybody's going, oh, isn't this one? No, it isn't wonderful. Those were 17,000 people that most likely died from absolutely horrid treatment.
Yes.
And you think this is a good deal? I don't. And
yeah, that's how they get rid of them. Well, I have
yes.
to give them credit for at least having cases. I've been... Well, I won't say I'm getting attention. I'm trying to get attention from the Oakland, California Police Department. One of their sergeants, I had a sort of a long talk with one of their sergeants who told me to my face that Oakland Police Department does not accept elder abuse complaints. So they don't have any problem with the backlog of elder abuse investigations because they simply don't investigate it. He goes, we don't have an elder abuse investigations unit. We don't investigate those cases. I say, well, that certainly keeps your caseload down, doesn't it?
Mini Christmas.
So we'll be working on Oakland Police Department in the months to come. And their chief just got fired a couple of weeks ago. So that was a good thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the chief got fired. I'd say, well, high time. What took you so long?
Yeah. You should have suggested he be put in a nursing home. And, but, you know, that's what I keep saying about the guardians. The best remedy for that is to guardianize them. They're a danger to society and everyone around them. So,
and
you know, we need to...
If you put someone in prison, they get out in a few years. But if we put them under conservatorship, they don't ever get out.
No, they never get out. There's no parole. There's no probation. Adios. Yes, I think that is absolutely. And the thing about that is, Linda, and I say that kind of facetiously, but these people are obviously, you cannot prey on anyone, much less those that are vulnerable and that are rendered defenseless by these tribunals. You can't prey on these people and tell me you're anything but either a sociopath or a psychopath. And the idea that there are so many of them walking around loose in the population actually kind of unnerves me because they look like normal people, but
well,
they aren't.
Well, can I expand the conversation to include regional centers? And this is something that might not be familiar in other states. I don't know if California is the only state that has this model, but it's the only one that I know of. We have the Lanterman Act, which sends a fair amount of state money and I think even some federal money to what we call regional centers. I think we have 51 of them in California. And these are supposed to be centers that provide services to persons with disabilities and to their families. And, you know, the goal was inclusion in the community, providing the supports that families need. Because imagine you have a child with autism or a child with perhaps severe developmental disabilities. We know that is going to be incredibly difficult, stressful for a family to try to care for that child. So the concept is for the state to have services to support these families, help them take care of their kids with disabilities, help them just get through the day. And there is a fair amount of money that follows each one of these children, and it's administered through the regional centers. And Sally can probably tell us more about regional centers because she knows about them much more than I do. But I'm now referring to your next guest, Sally Campa. And I have two letters here from the San Diego Regional Center The first, now bear in mind, these entities were established to help families. So everyone hold that in your heads. Etch this on the insides of your eyelids. Regional centers are there to help families. Okay, everybody got that? I'm looking at a letter from the San Diego Regional Center. This is from the service coordinator for Annette, who is Sylvia's daughter. And I'm going to scroll down here to page 3. And anybody who wants this letter, let me know. I'll be happy to send it to you. I'm going to read now. The service coordinator believes that the conservator should not be the mom, nor any family member or friend of the family.
Oh. And the reason for this is what?
Oh, my God. Because Sylvia was getting a little pushy about trying to get services for her daughter. I mean, the nerve of her.
Oh, my goodness.
She was trying to get services for her daughter. I mean, how dare she? But now I have another letter. And this one is from the regional manager for the East County region of San Diego. And I'm going to scroll down. And now I'm on page 7 of my PDF. In her last paragraph, she says, I strongly recommend that a public guardian outside of the family or current circle be appointed. So we have individuals from the regional center who don't want the mom or any family member or any friend of the family to be this young lady's conservator.
No, because they will advocate hard for her.
Sally did, which is why they're upset with her. So maybe we should let Sally tell her story about how she got to this place. Mm. Oh, and by the way, I won't the punchline. I'll let Sally do that.
Okay. All right. Sally, you ready?
Yes, thank you, Linda. Hello, Marty.
Hi.
Okay.
You've been through quite an ordeal. Yeah. Go ahead.
Basically, so my child has autism, and she is 24 years old. She was living mainly independent with her sister and 2 cats. And she had a job of 3 years, and everything was going fine. But I began pressuring the regional center for services. We were making a program of self-determination, they call it, which is a program to have them do their program on their own, which was in upwards of $150,000. So Linda is right that money really guides all these institutions. I was also helping other families get services between 20 and 23 families. And so they were not liking me at all. They retaliated. They sent APS, and they started sending police for welfare checks to my daughter's home, and ultimately making that 4-page report to the judge, the one Linda just read. And so the judge put a lot of weight on what the San Diego Regional Center said and suspended my conservatorship and gave my daughter over to the public guardian. Now, all this happened in just one day. And from then on, the public guardian just violated law after law, refused to communicate with me, and services were not provided to my daughter. 2 months later, they visited my daughter. It was just horrific until the unthinkable came in via email, and they just announced Annette is going, my daughter Annette is going to a group home in 2 days. So within 48 hours, my daughter was going to be moved to a group home along with 6 other unknown people, without her sister, without her cats, and my daughter fled to Mexico. Her father
Bless her
lived
heart.
In Mexico, and she left a note behind saying, leave me alone. I'm going to on a vacation with my dad. Blame her.
Yeah.
And so both the regional center, the public guardian, and now the court-appointed attorney But they all threatened me with kidnapping. The regional center immediately called the police department. The police department called me. Oh, my goodness. It was a nightmare. The district attorney's office, it was pretty big. And the public guardian director came to my house, pounding on my door, asking to see my daughter and where she, her whereabouts. And so, yeah.
Wow. Do you know, we've had a case like that here in Minnesota. Well, there's been several, but the one that's particularly high profile was Joanna Balgalis and her mother, Maria. And they were being pursued by First Fiduciary up here, a very large estate, and they fled the country. She got out of the country, not just that. I think this highlights your daughter and this case also, how severe these situations are, that people will actually flee the country, they have to flee the country to escape these people, to escape being kidnapped and isolated and basically cut off from everything they know, and God knows what's going to happen to them when you're not there to watch. And that we're hearing this all over the country, people actually fleeing the country to get away from these people. Now, I think when, like in your daughter's case, when you are being targeted so badly that you have to try to escape, not just leave the house where you're at, but leave the country, we got a problem. Somebody needs to pay attention. What's happening here? I mean, this is a severe reaction to this situation, and I don't blame your daughter a bit. Good for her for getting the hell out of here. Do they have any chance of getting her back up here?
Do they have any chance?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what the
laws
are.
Has she got dual citizenship? Does she have dual citizenship?
I believe her father has dual citizenship, and he's able to get her citizenship down in Mexico. That's a possibility, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, because I know in the Balgalis case, they have a dual citizenship, and the Greek government has stepped in to protect her from this predator running up here. She's safe there, and I would imagine your daughter is safe with her father. And can I ask how old she is?
24 years old.
Okay, so she's at past the age of consent. I mean, she can do what she wants to do. Why they would pursue her, but I think the reason is what you talked about with this regional center, this money that comes in there. She's worth her weight in gold inside that that center. You know, she's a source of revenue for them. So this is Jiminy Christmas. Where is this all at?
The court lawyer, the court-appointed attorney that was assigned to my daughter, hadn't even called her, touched base with her, nothing. And when my daughter disappeared, oh, she was right there with the judge. Oh, Your Honor, I am so worried. I need to absolutely be in contact with my client. You know, we're very worried. So
yes.
Now they're worried.
And then, yeah. They're worried about her, but they weren't worried about her. Yes, this is what really upsets me. These people, where do they come from? Who takes a job doing this kind of thing? And they do it repeatedly. They do it day after day after day. So there must be some sort of pleasure in it, I would think. And for them, you know what I'm saying. And then like this judge in your case, and I think you run under the tribunal system out there also. So this judge just basically, what do I want to say, just gave them a pass on everything, really didn't pay. I'm concerned about this woman writing this letter saying that none of the family, you and none of the family or none of her friends should be appointed conservator. That should have been a tip-off right there to anybody that was acting in a fair and unbiased manner. If this judge was capable of doing that, that they were acting in a fair and unbiased manner, is that they would accept this kind of recommendation because it obviously is intended to separate this girl from everything and everyone she knows. Why? Why?
Correct, Marty. And it's completely against the Lanternman Act. I also failed to mention that when they announced the group home, in the next paragraph, they said, and we are moving to immediately petition a permanent guardianship conservatorship. And that was unbelievably, incredibly painful.
Does she have her own income source?
She has SSI.
Yeah. And a lot of times what we're finding is, and I notice it out there in California, they're again moving to conserve or put under guardianship the people that are homeless. All of them will be put on SSI. They're going to do business by volume. Nobody's going to be helped. Nobody's going to be taken off the street. No one's going to get housing. No one's going to get anything. Whoever that conservator is, they're going to make themselves the assigned payee on those benefits and collect them, and they may give the individual $40 or so a month out of that money, but they're doing business by volume. That predator we have running out there in Detroit has 1,700 wards. Now, just think about that. 1,700 wards that she is collecting their Social Security and or military benefits or railroad retirement on, and stashes them in a residential home that she owns that's never been inspected. And she gives them $44 a month out of all the money she collects off of them. And she leaves them with no heat and without enough food. It's quite a deal. I mean, it's a good business to get into if you've got no morals or conscience. And
thank you very much. I do want to say that there are angels in from the just the universe comes in Linda Kincaid, and with her experience with her mother, like, she has helped my situation tremendously. The angle Linda brings in is shame them publicly, and we have gone along with the other guest you have to county supervisors. Bam, we went, and right there they brought in the director of the PG to talk to us. Then we went up to Capitol Hill, and then this week we're going to go to the I'm going to go to the Mexican consulate to let them know.
Yes.
You know, and keep pressing the publicity, and hopefully that may help us.
It does. I know with our family that's over there in Greece, and they left everything. They left the rest of the family. The mother's estate, the guardian has continued to drain, and reports to the court. Now, they've been notified, get this, Sylvia, they have been notified by the Greek embassy that Marie Bogalis is alive and well, and that they have talked with her personally, and they have checked on her, and she is alive and well. And the guardian keeps reporting to the probate court that she's missing, whereabouts unknown. And we have a, yes.
Well, isn't that pretty much, Sally, isn't that pretty much what they did at your hearing a couple days ago?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. They're like, we don't know where she's at. We don't know. Whereas I would constantly tell them, she's with her father. Look at the note. She's with her father. She always goes to her daddy's every month. That's where she's at. I sent you the address last month. Yes, but they're claiming they don't know where she's at. Is this what's happening to you?
Yes, and what I had them do was write a letter of notice to the court, to the fiduciary, to the judge specifically, to every one of the legislators here, and the attorney general's office, that here was this statement from the Greek embassy, and that she was alive and well, and that the fiduciary was continuing to bleed the estate, and even charging $3,000 a month for medical care on someone he claimed he didn't know where she was at. And he tried to take her Social Security and did for some time. And we finally got that back Marie gets her Social Security now, but all the money that was paid that the fiduciary collected, Social Security sent a letter to the family and said, this money needs to be paid back. So I said, write them back and tell them, then you go to the person you gave that check to and tell them you want the money back. And but he refuses to pay it. And, I mean, it's just, it's terrible. But send a letter of notice and that fraud is being perpetrated on the court. And this is what we did. And one of those, you know, notice to agent is notice to principal. Notice to principal is notice to agent. Blah, blah, blah. This is where she's at. You've been duly notified. She is alive and well. And please stop reporting her as missing. Whereabouts unknown, because you have been fully informed on numerous occasions. And, but this is what we did to get that stopped. But see, we have a 4-year death, what do they call that? In absentia, death in absentia, which would be end this month. And it would allow the fiduciary to simply consume the entire estate and then to hell with Marie. This is just the way this goes. They don't care about her. They want that money. They want the estate. And, you know, as Linda said, you know, this whole thing is about money. It is never about the individual, what is best for them. It's about getting control of them like they're attempting to do with your daughter. And they don't care the effects of that. They don't care the effects to the family, how this, you know, is going to affect everybody. And people need to understand this. This doesn't just affect the person they targeted. By extension, it affects the whole family. And in some cases, large sections of the community. This isn't just a, you know, one person. It affects all of these people. And the misery this causes and the frustration and the anger is just immeasurable. The money ceases to be an issue in and of itself. It's what they're doing, because I've told people we are just a breath away from setting up an auction block in the public and auctioning them off. Linda, do you remember here about, was it 4 or 5 years ago? I don't know if you saw this or not. I believe it was either Indiana or Ohio started publishing pictures and names of people online who needed a guardian, and they were taking bids. They were taking bids that these people needed a guardian in this area, that area, and they were taking bids on who was going to guardianize this person, that they needed help, and this was the only way they knew, and they were auctioning them off. And we raised so much fire about that, they finally took it down, but I have no doubt it's still running in the background. You know, it's running below the radar. But this is what they're doing. They are auctioning these people off. And everybody is making money. You have to think about this in the context of the community. You take one person who's on Social Security, for instance, and that's all they have. But that person in the system is generating a ton of money in the local economy between the guardian and the attorneys and the medical providers and like your regional care center. Everybody's making money off that one person. And so you take that person out of the system, that cash flow stops. And this is the biggest driver. Like Linda said, it's money, 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 money. Where's the money? Who's got it? We want it. That's basically all this gets down to. If they actually cared about people and this was about care, things would be entirely different. I think California last year under their block grant out of Title 20 Social Security, I think California got somewhere around $80 million. And about $30 million of that was earmarked for elder services. I think for $30 million, wow. I can do a lot of good stuff, you know, but that's me.
Well, you could also pay a lot of attorneys with that amount of money.
Yes, you could, couldn't you, Linda? Yes. And that's probably where it's going,
Marty.
To. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate
Thank
it.
You. I also want to take this time to just let you know that I'm starting a nonprofit. Macro, it's called Mothers Against Conservatorship Oppression. And I'd like to, you know, begin connecting with other moms and families.
Yes. Please do. Please do.
All right.
And we'll get as many of them on air as we can.
Okay, good. I'll forward you my information.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, Linda, what's up next?
I think we have Monica on the line, and she will have a long story to tell you about her nephew Ryan, and probably she'll. And I expect she'll also tell you about the young lady who was in the same foster home where Ryan was for a while, and that young woman just died, wrongful death.
Oh wow!
And Monica has been following that very closely and getting publicity about it.
Well, okay, Monica, are you ready to go?
I'm ready. Thank you for having me on the show, Marty, and thank you for inviting me, Marty and Linda.
Monica, may I ask, Monica, you got a lot of reverb. Are you up by chance on speaker?
I am.
Could you shut that down, please? We get a lot of feedback when you have your phone on speaker.
Okay, is that better?
Yes, much.
Is that better? Okay, great.
Yes.
So, my name is Monica Mukai, and I'm actually Ryan's maternal aunt. His biological mother is my elder sister. And unfortunately, Ryan was born into a system as described in the write-up here on your website, where Riverside now is abusing him, Riverside County, rather, and while he was just a toddler and a child, an infant even, really had some troubles in the Orange County Social Services Department. So he's 26 years old. He was born with cerebral palsy. He's actually an identical twin, and his identical twin brother and older sisters were raised by my mother, who's an Italian grandma and really wants to keep her family together. So she raised her three grandchildren and tried her hardest to have Ryan reunited into the family. And unfortunately, it was a time when in California, grandparents didn't really have rights in the early 90s. And especially an Italian immigrant speaking in an Orange County courtroom with an Italian interpreter was very different. We were often told that if she was on the East Coast in an Italian community, this case would have ended up very differently. But for Ryan, he was actually unfortunately placed in a foster care home that was with a woman by the name of Michelle Morris at 3.5 years old. They actually split the twins up and allowed my mother to become the legal guardian of his twin brother, Ronald, but didn't allow Ryan to come home. In fact, I remember reading one of the reports with the social worker that said that we will not give the grandmother any more concessions. And I thought to myself, I cannot believe the language that they use.
Yes, yes.
They're calling concessions in a sense of visitation or any type of reunification. And as you know, when you folks were talking about the money, even back then, you got paid more as an institution of government for adopting a child than you did for reunifying them in the family system. So anyhow, he was adopted. My sister has disabilities of her own, his mother, and unfortunately the court system favored the former adoption social worker who became the foster mother, and then her MO has been to prey upon vulnerable persons or vulnerable parents, rather, and terminate their parental rights to make them adoptable and then go for the adoption. And we ended up settling in hopes to have visitation for 6.5 hours for the rest of his life. So we settled for visitation.
Wait a minute, Monica. 6 hours for the total of the rest of his life was all you got?
No, 6 hours a week. I'm sorry. Six hours a week for the rest of his life. And as soon as she adopted him, she would not obey the court order. And we had just gone into 8 years of litigation, and in order to get her to obey the court order, we would have had to go right back to court. At that point, we were extremely exhausted. And so for the next 13 years, we didn't see him because she refused to give those 6.5 hours per week. So he didn't see his identical twin brother, his older sisters, or his grandmother who fed him every single night when he was an infant by bottle. And it was devastating for the family. And we always wondered what he thought, not ever knowing that what had happened to us. When he turned 21 years old, my mother and my eldest sister went to knock on the door at Michelle Morris's home. And they did get through the large gate because there was she left Orange County and went to Riverside County after suing the Regional Center of Orange County for sexual abuse against her children, which we found out then and later on even it was confirmed that it was her staff that was sexually abusing Ryan in her home, in the jacuzzi, and also in Ryan's bed. So he was raped in her home and in Orange County. And then, but she turned around and sued Regional Center. A Regional Center we thought for sure was going to win. Unfortunately, the insurance company asked for a settlement, and she took the money that she received for the settlement and ran to Riverside County and bought a big estate with walls and camera systems at each of the gates and continued on her business. And in 2015, I had learned that she had already adopted 13 children many of who have already aged, and she was continuing to take in several foster care children. And the my mother insisted on having some sort of communication and contact with him, at which time her husband refused and said that if you don't leave my property now, we're going to call the police on you. My eldest sister and my niece, Ryan's sister as well, did some investigation online, found out all the public records that we could, grabbed all the public records they could get from the online download, which no longer exists. You can't download them online. You have to go to the courthouse. But at that time, we found a piece of paper that was a glaring lie that Michelle had said that the co-conservator had brought Ryan to see his biological family. We knew that didn't happen, so we investigated to speed up the system, speed up the story. When we investigated, we found out that Ryan had been married to one of her male staff who was double Ryan's age. Yes, so she had married him to her employee, and we didn't have an issue with him being a male. You know, we have other cousins that are in homosexual relationships, and we love them just the same. However, we later found out, and he was double the age of Ryan, which, you know, we had a little challenge with, but at the same time, we totally accepted that he's married, he's happy. This is what we were being reported, and we are going to accept his husband, Sean Spicer, as part of the family. So we did, until we realized that Sean Spicer was actually abusing Ryan just as well as Michelle Morris. We fought to have Michelle Morris and her her sidekick or manager, best friend, Susan Bird Santo, removed from conservatorship of Ryan, and they actually were removed, or they resigned in face of a deposition. And it was no wonder she actually married Ryan off to one of her male employees at that time, because it was 3 months before her adoption assistance was going to sunset. She was collecting, according to Sean Spicer, $5,300 a month that she never gave a dime to Sean or Ryan when he was living with Sean. And she collected this money for months that Ryan was living with Sean instead. And didn't report that he was married, didn't report that he moved residence, which is required by a conservator and the court of law. And we soon found out that, and Sean actually exposed a lot of abuse that he had learned of that took place beyond the sexual abuse and the rape, that Michelle Morris would be threatening Ryan with psychotropic drugs as a form of punishment and tell him that if you know, because you're behaving this way, you're going to have to take this now. You take it and forcing it upon him. And then also not only using chemical restraint, which is a form of elder abuse and dependent adult
yes.
abuse, but she would also use emergency treatment services as a form of punishment and tell him that if he didn't follow her rules, that she was going to send him to emergency treatment services on a 5150 hold. That
what is emergency services,
type of behavior,
Monica?
It's
what is
emergency
services?
Treatment services is a lockdown facility where they keep you on a 72-hour hold. They call it a 5150 hold in here in California. And many times they'll remove you from your home in handcuffs or on a gurney, strapped down on a gurney. And Ryan actually continued to receive that type of treatment from Sean Spicer, his husband. And before I even learned of that, however, I had learned that Ryan wanted to continue to come out and visit because we started visiting with Ryan once Michelle resigned. And that was in 2015. And Sean became appointed the successor conservator. And when he became the successor, he allowed Ryan to have visits with his identical twin brother, myself, and all of his extended biological family, which went super well. I invited Ryan and Sean to have extended weekend visits at my house and utilize the guest room like their own and stay, you know, a couple nights on the weekends. And Ryan became so fond of being at my house and especially seeing his identical twin brother and extended family members and doing things outside of what he was normally doing out where he was in Riverside, that he wanted to spend more and more time with us. And Sean felt threatened because he felt like he was losing Ryan. And Ryan, of course, established a very intimate, reuniting with his identical twin brother, which I don't think
right.
anyone can be closer than a twin. And so he
right.
wanted to be with him more than his husband. And in his own deposition that we took in the summer of 2017, Ryan had said that he didn't want to be married. He acknowledged that he thought his wedding was actually a baptism. And he says that in the wedding video that we received from Sean. He says, "Sean, what is this? I've never done this before. I'm not used to this." And everybody's just laughing at him. And he says, "Baptized in the name of Jesus," when he's supposed to put the ring on Sean's finger. And he admitted that he thought it was a baptism. And it became evident that Sean was abusing him just like his adopted mother did. And that Ryan wasn't the 20-year-old that we had just been reintroduced to. And that's what we thought. We were going to be meeting a 20-year-old. In fact, we later
right.
found out that Ryan has the mentality of a kindergartner. So here is a kindergartner. He's being married off by his conservators, and which we found out even from Sean Spicer that his adopted mother and the other co-conservator had never stepped foot in the house to verify that it was a safe place for Ryan to live. So here she is, this woman saying that this is my son and I love him and he's been in my house since he was 3.5 years old, but yet she would marry him off to one of her employees and never even step foot in the house that he was moving into. That she would never call him. She would never even call him to out of the blue just to find out how he was doing. So we had succeeded in removing him from the clutches of Michelle Morris, the foster and then adopted mother, and then removing him from his husband, who was an abusive husband. In fact, the ruling just came out last May that he was to be removed from Sean, his husband, for the numerous instances of abusive behavior. And there was no way that the judge, after everything that we put into evidence, would be able to leave him and the abusive household with an abusive husband. But yet, when she wrote this in her ruling, she didn't have any type of recovery plan. She didn't request the new conservator, who she made the temporary conservator to be the county of the county of Riverside with the public guardian's office. And she didn't ask them to do any type of recovery treatment plan for all of the years of abuse that he had suffered sexually, emotionally, physically, and psychologically. And it's just unfathomable that the public guardian's office, basically run by county council, their attorney is doing everything in their power to listen to and take the lead of Ryan's attorney, and Ryan's court-appointed attorney is also just basically trying to put Ryan right back in the abusive situation with the abusive husband. And we're trying to change that course of action, because Ryan's attorney, the taxpayers' dollars with the court-appointed attorney, is actually appealing the decision of the judge to protect Ryan, and instead wants him right back with the abuser. And
now
he's already asked for three extensions.
That?
Yeah, his basically his public defender, but it's called a court-appointed counsel and a court-appointed attorney here and Riverside Court. And he is getting paid, obviously, to continue to produce more and more conflict, as Linda Kincaid said, and also to extend. He's on appeal, which he won't win. There's no way they can win, because the judge only needs one reason, and the judge has like over a dozen reasons why she made the ruling that she did, and it's really left to the discretion of the judge. So he's just throwing a wrench in the system so that he can continue to bill hours. And I just can't believe it. He's already asked for three extensions. So this can go on for another, 2 to 3 years just in the appellate court.
Right.
And all the while, Ryan needs so much. He needs so many resources and services that are available to him, and he's not receiving. His speech is worse than it was in 2015. It's worse than it was in 2017. He is not receiving the socialization or the community orientation in the least restrictive living environment possible that he's afforded by law. And the public guardian's office is only giving, at best, 1 to 2 hours a month for him to visit with his identical twin brother or myself. And each time that Ryan has had those visits, which we haven't had since January 9th, Ryan says that he's still so shaken and afraid of all of threats of punishment and actual reality of what had happened when he would talk about his twin brother or want to visit with his twin brother, or even the idea of calling on the phone. And not only was that his abusive adopted mother and abusive husband being the perpetrators of this type of dependent adult abuse, but this dependent adult abuse was also even extended as far as that Ryan had expressed his own attorney had told him that if he gets a phone, not to call Ronald, his twin brother, or me, and not to visit with us, not to call us by phone and not to visit with us, or he wouldn't win this battle.
And why would that be? Why would they not want him to have contact with you? What valid reason could they have for that?
Because Ryan will become more and more bonded, and the reunification of the family will take place, and they will no longer exist in being able to create this conflict. Ryan asked me at one of the visits if my plan was to take him home with me. He asked, the last phone conversation I had with him, the last visit he had on the phone was when he called me after an extended visit, which he came out by himself that time in December of 2015. And he called me the next morning and said, Sia, are you going to come pick me up for Christmas? And Sean got on the phone and said, no, you're not getting him for Christmas. We already have plans, and hung up the phone.
Oh.
And Ryan had two cell phones at the time, and he used to call his twin brother and myself all the time. And that was since 2015. He hasn't had access to his own cell phone where he can call his family. So he's been completely isolated. And it's his human rights, his conservancy rights, are completely violated. And I just can't believe it's happening, and it's continuing to happen in this nation. But the more I've learned and connecting with Linda Kincaid and all of the advocates throughout the state, and hearing about Annette's story that Sally's dealing with, it's repeated over and over and over again how horrendous and broken the system is.
Well, the unfortunate part of it is
doing our best as well.
Monica, the system isn't broken. It isn't broken. It's running exactly the way they intended it to run. And because it is not broken, it's just an adversarial system that is set against you. You have no rights. You have no advantage in that system at all. It needs to be abolished altogether and something else put in place that preserves the rights and the protections of the individual. And the monetary portion of it needs to be removed. This continual tapping of resources and estates and everything, there needs to be a cap on this. And if somebody wants to get into this system of dealing with people who are in this situation, there should be a limit on the amount of money they can make, and you do it for a X amount of dollars, whatever that amount is. And this thing of, as Linda pointed out, billing by the hour. I've dealt with cases where these guardians and attorneys have billed as much as $500 for writing a letter, $300 for putting it in the mailbox. One show I did out there in Northern California a few years back, the attorneys for the person conserved charged $300 per hour for themselves and two of their staffers to listen to my radio show. And this is how bad this is. It is an open door to racketeering and theft. Like I say, the system isn't broken. They set the system up. It's running just exactly the way they wanted it to. And they're all making money. It needs to be abolished. It needs to be done away with. And the rights of the individual need to be upheld above and beyond everything. If somebody is at such a disadvantage, is so vulnerable that they need a protector of sorts, wouldn't that indicate to you that morally the thing to do would be to move to make sure that all their rights were preserved, that they were protected, that they were taken care of, and instead they're thrown to the wolves? Literally just thrown to the wolves. And
now, Marty,
they're like an ATM.
This is Linda. I'd like to interject a comment about this particular court-appointed attorney, because I know him better than I would like to. The court-appointed attorney that Monica has been talking about, the court-appointed attorney for Ryan Morris, was also the court-appointed attorney for my mother when she was under conservatorship. So Monica was talking about how this court-appointed attorney is trying to send Ryan back to the home where he was married to his conservator, who was twice his age, is trying to scare Ryan and tell him that if you want to see your biological family, you will be punished. You know, this is the strategy he's currently using in Ryan's case. But if we go back 8 or 9 years to my mom's case, the same court-appointed attorney told the court that he opposed my mother having contact with her family because it might inconvenience the facility. He opposed my mother being removed from the facility where she was sexually assaulted. And 3 weeks after that hearing, my mom was in the ER with vaginal bleeding, a woman in her 70s having vaginal bleeding. That court-appointed attorney coached the conservator
on strategy, how to isolate my mom from her family. And we know how much he got paid because we got the accountings on the estate, and he billed about $250,000 to my mom's estate. In Ryan's case, he's billing the county of Riverside, and they won't hand over the invoices, so we don't know how much he's getting paid for trying to put Ryan back into an abusive situation. But I think
Linda,
these two cases...
If he's working for the county, that should be a member, part of the public record. They can't hide that.
Yeah, you think so, wouldn't you? Well, so far they are. They're saying it's confidential. Monica and one of her associates are trying to get those records. So far the county hasn't been willing to provide them. But I think it really exemplifies the point that we made in the beginning, that it's about money. It's not about what was best for my mom or what is best for Ryan. It's about billable hours. And what better way to keep those billable hours coming than to know that your loved one is being abused?
Yes.
You know, if you think if your mom is being isolated, if you believe your mother is being physically abused or sexually abused, you will keep going to court and fighting until you don't have a penny left. And if you believe that your nephew is isolated from you, potentially could be sexually abused again, you will keep fighting and fighting and fighting, and all of that equals billable hours for the court-appointed attorney. And I really think it is that simple.
Wow. Wow. That's so disgusting. I can't even... I say, where do these people come from? Who is this deficient in character and integrity and morality that you would conduct business this way, that you would use other people as a means of profiting? This is...
I call it legalized human trafficking. Yep.
Yes, it is. It is trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
I know up here in Minnesota, we have brought this aspect of it up to the legislature several times, that it's human trafficking. And I was told, oh, don't refer to it as that. They don't like that. And they get really upset when you use that term. And your point? I get really upset when they...
Well, I believe the court just called it racketeering.
Yeah. Excuse me, mm-hmm. I get upset when you traffic the elderly for profit. So I guess
mm-hmm.
we're both upset. And what is the difference? I mean, honestly, with what you're talking about, Monica, Linda, what you've been covering for years and years, what is the difference between that and people who snatch kids and traffic them? There's no difference.
Mm-mm.
Only difference is the
isn't.
Age. It's just the age and
mm-hmm.
who's paying the bill. It's the same thing. I keep telling people we are the greatest product of this country, and that's how the government, state and federal, views us. We are commodities. They are buying, selling, and trading us and our labor. And
mm-hmm.
so when in talking to people out in D.C., they said, well, you know, it's not really trafficking. We're doing the best we can. And with the boomer generation, you know, and get off of that. I don't want to hear that. And the other thing is, this is, when it comes to the elderly, people talk about the transfer of wealth. Oh, they want to take from the rich and give to the poor. No, that's not what's happening. We are taking from the elderly and profiting these predators operating in this system. And that is the greatest transfer of wealth. Families are being disinherited. Linda, in your own case, you know, every dime you went to trying to save your mother.
Correct.
And their families are being bankrupted. I know when I was first in this, I was stunned to hear families say they had mortgaged their home 2 and 3 times to pay these attorneys mm-hmm. who didn't represent them. And they had
mm-hmm.
spent their kids' as college funds trying to save mom, dad, or whomever. And yet there was no end in sight. And, you know, Linda, you made the observation at the beginning of the show. You go into this system. There's no escape. There's no parole, no probation. There's never anything. Usually the only way you get out of it is dead. And this is unacceptable. I don't understand. And where are lawmakers,
well,
whether state or federal? Go ahead.
We are starting to have some other ideas come forward. And you know, Monica and Sylvia and I just spent the weekend in Sacramento at a conference, and this is something that's fairly new, supported decision making. There is a case, I believe it is in Virginia. If people want to see a real success story, Google Jenny Hatch and supported decision making. Jenny Hatch is a young woman with Down syndrome, and she got out of guardianship with the help of some fantastic advocates. And now we're going to try to bring that concept to California. I think Sally's daughter, Annette, is the perfect candidate for our first case. But I think Monica's nephew, Ryan, would also be a good case. And Monica, why don't I let you talk about what you learned this weekend about supported decision-making and how this might replace conservatorship for both Annette and for Ryan.
Well, yes, I was actually going to say that supported decision-making is a concept that I've known about, but not in this context for those with disabilities and self-determination and recognizing that, for instance, Ryan had a 7:30 evaluation with a psychologist. It, you know, by the end of the day with the testimony and such, it was close to $20,000 later. However, he did rule, or he did find rather in his evaluation, that Ryan did not have the mental capacity to be married at the time that he was married when he was 20, or to remain married when he was 25, and that he was not able at the time to have any real understanding of what it is to have self-dignity and self-determination, because he was never provided those opportunities to do so. He was always told what to do and how to do it, and if he didn't do as he was told, he would be punished. One of the favorite things Ryan has said continuously since we were reunited in 2015 was, am I going to be in trouble? He would ask that question all the time. Even when he was visiting with us, he was worried that his adopted mother would show up. He used it in court with the judge, and he's been using it in the visits in the last year as well, that he was thinking he was going to constantly be in trouble. So he was constantly oppressed to the point where he didn't really understand that he had the ability to make decisions. And even in his deposition, he reiterated that he does want to. When he was asked, do you want to be able to make decisions for yourself? He said yes. And he this self-determination model shared supported decision-making model would be phenomenal for him because it's something he's never had an opportunity to do. And like I said, if you know, he said he didn't want to be married in his deposition in 2017, and nobody did anything about it. Even today, after the judge ruled that it appeared he didn't have the capacity to be married, and the public guardian's office keeps him married, it just doesn't make sense that they're not listening to anything he is saying. In fact, during mediation, when the judge ordered us to go into mediation, Ryan was nowhere to be found. His attorney showed up, but Ryan didn't. When we asked for him to show up, you know, his identical twin brother was there. His identical twin brother's attorney was there. I was there. His mom showed up. His adopted mom showed up, and she wasn't supposed to even be there. And Ryan was nowhere to be found. We asked for him to show up and be a part of this since it was about him, and it never was scheduled.
But how could that's how much. You and Sally had this fantastic conversation with Suzanne Francisco about how you could start to. Now, obviously, you're dealing with a public guardian. That will be an impediment. But let's say we overcome that obstacle of the public guardian, and now we're trying to transition Ryan into a different model. Let's think about things that we would do for Ryan or for Annette. You know, obviously, Ryan can't go get a bank account and get a lease on an apartment and buy a car and take care of himself independently. He doesn't have the mental capacity, nor does he have any training in those sorts of things. So what would we start doing? Where would we start? I think they talked about a supported decision-making team.
Yes, and I was asking who the facilitator would be in a situation like that, especially considering Ryan's situation is very different from Annette, and that he has very unsafe people in his life, in his immediate
Correct.
Life, and he's still visiting with them. So who would be the facilitator and who would be these team members is very important in making sure to continue to protect him, because as you know, disabled adults and disabled children are some of the most vulnerable and susceptible to various types of abuses. And Ryan, actually Suzanne Franklin, Bennett Franklin, who was actually did the workshop on supported decision making, had suggested a therapist would be a good alternative to having like a typical counselor or therapist person facilitate. A speech therapist would be an ideal person that would be an unbiased party member that could help, and any other trusted member of Ryan's or Annette's circle of family and friends that could assist in their decision-making process. So I thought that was a fabulous model, because Ryan has been such a voiceless member of his own life. And it would really give him an opportunity to establish the self-dignity and self-determination that the doctor suggested he absolutely needs in order to move on in his 20s. He's 26 years old. He's not a six-year-old.
Right. Well, you know, the thing is, too, granted, maybe some of these professionals should be involved in that decision making, but for the most part, in my opinion, this should be people just like he's already bonded with you, his brother, and others. These are the people he needs around him for support, because they're going to be looking out for his best interest, not what's going to make them money. And they're going to have an intuitive need to protect him. So they're going to act in his best interest, more than likely. The first I heard of shared, responsibilities there, decision-making, was NASCA came out with it here about 6-7 years ago. And, of course, they were getting opposition all over the place. And they appeared, Minnesota just brought out, I spoke about this horrendous legislation that's come out, and supported decision making was mentioned in one of the bills. But of course, it was all to be strangers to the family and to the victim, to make sure things were handled. In other words, people, the stakeholders, and I hate that term so bad, I can't stand it. Stakeholders, whenever you see that, means those who have a vested interest in this issue, because it's going to make the money. And I just despise that word to no end. It's a cover-all for all the predators in the system. And so that in and of itself, as long as it is by people who have an instinctive love for this person and need to protect them, as you obviously do, to help him make his way and show him what he needs to know and help him with that. They aren't interested in that at all, as far as I can see. You talked about him always being afraid he's in trouble. One of the things we've discussed at length with the people in Australia is what I call torture-based bonding and the isolation of these individuals caught in these situations and the fear factor that drives it. And you get what is commonly known as the Stockholm Syndrome. Pretty soon they start identifying with their captors, and they do it out of fear and their own sense of keeping themselves safe.
Survival.
They'll go, survival. And so when this is taking place, that person is already at a disadvantage. I am all for supported decision making, but it should be by family members or friends, people who genuinely care for that person, not by these strangers who see them simply as some kind of ATM.
With the supportive decision making that was discussed at the conference, the decider, who would be Annette or Ryan, the decider gets to pick people they're going to trust. And you know, let's go back to Annette's case, and I've sort of grabbed hold of Annette's case because hers is such an obvious perfect case. There really was no reason for Annette to have ever been placed under conservatorship. This girl graduated high school. She's worked a job the last 3 years. She was living semi-independently with her sister. She has a mom who cares about her. She has a dad who cares about her. She has a sister. She has a brother who are involved in her life. She has a speech therapist she's had a relationship with for years, who's known her since she was a young child, and she's very fond of him, and he's very much an advocate for her. You know, Annette already has this circle. It's just a matter of getting rid of the public guardian so that the people who care about her can actually help her and let her start to express herself and express her rights again.
Yes.
I grant
yes.
that Ryan's going to be more difficult. Ryan's going to be a tough one. And that's why I brought it up to Suzanne in Sacramento. Was, you know, this is kind of at the other end. We've got a young man who is fairly seriously impaired. You know, he was evaluated with a mental capacity of a kindergartner. You know, that's not someone who can really have the abilities to take over his own life. However, a kindergartner can express his wishes.
Mm-hmm.
And Suzanne mm-hmm. said, you start with simple things. Do you want to wear your red shirt or your blue shirt?
Yes.
You start to establish that you get to make decisions about your life, and also the importance of risk and the importance of making mistakes. You know, how did mm-hmm. all of us learn what worked and what didn't? We learned because we made mistakes. So we said, oops, that
yes.
didn't work. I'm not going to do it that way again.
Yes. Well, and that's the thing. And with this young man also, obviously no one has made any effort whatsoever to educate him, to teach him anything. And many times people who are challenged in this way, they learn by rote, by doing it over and over and over again. It may take time and patience, but a lot of times mm-hmm. they can grasp a lot more than what many people would give them credit for. It takes them longer to learn.
Yeah, Ryan's
so,
never had the opportunity,
and
so we don't know what he can
yes.
learn.
Exactly.
Yeah, he has
exactly.
not had the opportunity at all, because he was actually in a home that was with severely disabled individuals. He was the only one that walked and talked. Everyone else was in wheelchairs.
Oh, God.
And God bless them. Most of them were fed with feeding tubes and didn't talk. And beyond that, he didn't really have an education. He was not taught
yeah.
how to read or write, even though she had a home school that the state of California's taxpayers were paying for. And that actually got shut down.
You know, a communication assisted device with icons where he might be able to communicate by tapping icons?
Yes, he definitely could. He can speak, and he just needs help with his speech. He needs speech therapy on a regular basis, and they're saying that he doesn't have it anymore because he's too old, which whether he's 26 or 6, he should still have speech therapy. He definitely
yes.
needs it. And I know yes. that he can graduate and learn how to write, read and even type. He wants to learn how to read and type. He wants to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
He's said 5 times now that he wants to go to college, and he's still not in college. They're not doing anything to help him. He's been off of the internet. Who is off of the internet their entire life? They won't
wow.
let him go on the internet unless it's extremely, it's not even like they do it with a child. Like he literally, his adopted mother kept him off the internet entirely and told him that he was going to run into Gramita, and she would scare him from going onto the internet. Then the husband did the same thing, kept him off of the internet unless he was right there in front of him to watch what he was looking at. And it was very, very, very limited. And right now, today with the public guardian's office, he doesn't have access to a phone, and he doesn't have access to the internet either. So how is he supposed to learn? If he's not in school, he doesn't get the internet. He doesn't even have a cell phone to call and speak to people. That he's isolated. He's completely, and I agree with
yes.
you about the Stockholm syndrome. And that actually was brought up in trial by an expert, that he definitely has Stockholm syndrome. Because he's even said that it's okay. What Sean has done to him is, it's okay. I still love him. But he
yeah.
has no concept of what it could be like. He just knows that this
yes.
is what it was.
Well, and that's the thing. If you don't, and you know this from, I know it from having small children. have raised two generations of them. You have to, even with a child that isn't challenged, you have to go over things and go over things and go over things with them until they get the idea, until they understand, and they can put it into play in their own lives. You know, they can access it in their own lives. And so to take someone who is challenged and take all of this away from them, any chance they have of moving ahead, of being and accomplishing everything they possibly can, I think that is a severe form of abuse. It keeps him dependent. It keeps him at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And it provides them the means to keep him isolated. The older he gets, the more isolated he becomes. And eventually it will reach the point where he can't be reintegrated. This will be so much a part of, he's learned from what they've shown him. Okay, this is what he knows. And at this age, it's going to be hard. Go ahead.
You know, I think these disability cases are so important. You know, as you know, I came to this issue because of my mother, and most of the cases that I've investigated and been involved with have been dealing with elders, because that was the way I saw this issue for a long time, and I'm only now becoming more aware of the very same situations with younger people who have disabilities. And, you know, I don't want to diminish anyone's case. They're all important. Every single individual has the right to live with dignity and to express themselves and to be with the people they love. Everyone has that right. But I'm starting to see the disability cases in some ways as being a lot worse. Because when it's an older person, let's use my mother's case as an example, because that's the one that's most familiar to me. You know, she lived for 3 years after she was placed under conservatorship. And those were a horrible 3 years for her and for me. But as I was going through it, I always knew that it would end. I always knew the day would come when it would be over, and then I could make the choice of how to go on with my life and what I wanted to do next. But imagine yourself in the position of a mom, or in this case an aunt, or someone who has a younger person in their family with a disability, and it's not going to end in 3 years or 5 years. This is going to be forever.
Yes.
And the predators will be there forever, and the people wanting money from them will be there forever. You know, so what I experienced for 3 years could go on for 30 or 60. And so I think we really need to get some attention on these younger folks and really start moving toward the supported decision-making model, because this is a lifetime sentence for whoever it is. But for some people, it's a one-year sentence or a three- or a five-year sentence. For Ryan or Annette, it could be a 60-year sentence.
Yes. Yes, I agree, Linda. I agree. And like I say, I think the fact that they are targeting elderly people or disabled people in this manner is just indicative of how horrid this system is. You cannot look at this from any angle and not realize that it is a form of government-sanctioned human trafficking for profit. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. And you can't look at it any other way, because no matter how you look at all the evidence that's assembled, I mean, just imagine in outside of this arena, if you were a private individual and you did any one of these things to that young man, you'd be in jail. Mm-hmm. You would be in jail. They would prosecute you to death. And yet these professional predators can do it all day long to numerous people, and they get the nod from the court, and away they go, and nothing is done about it. For some reason, it's okay when they do it. It's just not okay if you did it. And the thing is, you would never treat him the way they have. You would never subject him to the things they have subjected him to. You would never do these things, and yet for some reason you shouldn't be his conservator. Now, what's wrong with that picture?
Yeah, they still haven't even heard. You know, right back to that letter that we looked at an hour and a half ago from the San Diego Regional Center, where they're saying the conservator should not be the mom or any family member or any friend of the family. That's in Annette's case. If we could get a hold of all of the records in Ryan's case, I expect we would find something similar in that case from his regional center. You know, and these are government contractors paid by our tax dollars, tearing families apart. We hear so much about families being torn apart at the border. Well, they're being torn apart inside the country, too.
Well, and the police do nothing about it.
Right, and I've tried to point this out repeatedly. People come up with all excuses of this group or that group is destroying the traditional family. Oh, they're the wrong religion, or maybe they're gay, or they're this, and they're destroying the traditional family. They're not destroying anything. The only people with the power to do that is the government, and they're doing it. They're, on the one end, they're taking our elderly and profiting off of them and then euthanizing them in hospice. On the other end, they're snatching our kids and forcing them into foster care or forcibly adopting them out for profit. That's who's destroying the family. That's, they're the only ones with the power to do that. People you don't
and
know
the government
and most likely
protecting.
Never will. Yes.
I was just going to say
people,
that the government is completely protecting, they completely protect themselves.
Yes.
Eve, I'm sure you've mentioned before, I'm guessing, Linda, about the 1987 Riverside County Sheriff's Department outdated policy.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh,
yeah.
And
well,
yeah, this is in Riverside County, which is where Ryan currently is. We've, again, been taking a law enforcement agency to task. I mentioned Oakland Police Department told me to my face they don't investigate elder abuse. Well, in Riverside County, the sheriff has an abuse policy dated from 1987.
Oh.
Their policy is older than Ryan, and it essentially says nothing. It basically says if you see a crime against an elder or dependent adult, report it to social services. You don't have to do anything.
That'll... Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to provide protection of the laws if the person is elderly or disabled. You just refer this off to social services.
Yeah, and that is the last place you want to go. Yeah,
exactly. And the social workers, I don't know how much time we have, Marty.
Just a couple of minutes here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Then I won't share that because there was a death in her home, and now her license is no longer, and the regional center is not providing any funding to her anymore.
We have a couple of minutes. Tell us about Princess Diane.
So with Ryan's matter, I pleaded with the Board of Supervisors on May 1st, 2018, requesting them to investigate Sean Spicer, Michelle Morris, and Susan Bird Santo. And not only just that date, but several times we've requested from the DA's office and the Sheriff's Department. They did nothing. And then on May 6th, Diane Princess Ramirez was placed in Michelle Morris's home. She was 16 at the time. She functioned as a 16-year-old, although she had severe cerebral palsy. But mentally, she operated as a 17-year-old when she died a tragic death, where she was left moaning and throwing up for 8 hours.
Oh.
And Michelle did nothing. Staff even wanted her to call 911. And she was told just 3 days before that if Diane were to decline to call 911 and have her transported immediately to the ER, she waited 8 hours of her moaning and throwing up bile and blood all night long and died. Michelle surrendered her license, and she surrendered her license, and then she was devenderized, and then now finally the Adult Protective Services is starting to find, and the Child Protective Services are starting to find some of these allegations that they all left before unfounded and undetermined. And they're now starting to recognize, and they started substantiating the referrals of abuse. So now she has abuse, and there's a $25 million lawsuit against her and the County of Riverside for wrongful death of Diane Ramirez. On April 6th of this year, we have it will be 1 year from the date of her death, her tragic death, and we will be protesting in front of the Riverside County offices at 5 p.m. On Monday, April 6th. And then on the following morning, April 7th, we'll be speaking to the Board of Supervisors at the Board of Supervisors meeting under public comments.
All right. We've just got about 50 seconds. Yeah, we've got about 50 seconds left here. Keep us updated on that. And Linda, if you need airtime for any of that, let me know. I'll get something arranged for you. And I want to thank you all for coming on. Yeah, Linda, it was nice to have you back with us again, and we will do this again. Like I say, keep us updated. For everyone that tuned in tonight, thank you. It looks like we had a very large audience. If you have any comments, contact me at tsrad1.com. That's tsrad1, like Twisted Sister, rad1@outlook.com, and I'll forward any messages to Linda. And Linda is with Coalition for Elder and Disability Rights. That goes by the call name Cedar. So you can look her up. They do a lot of good work. With that, I have to say good night. Thank you, everyone. Linda, thank you. Monica, thank you. And we will talk again.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.